Welcome to the Tai Fellowship Podcast. I'm Catherine Gretzinger. Today, our guest is the writer Sandra Shields. Sandra lives in the Fraser Valley of British Columbia. The place is known as one of Canada's richest agricultural areas, and it's also a place rich in Aboriginal culture. The Stolo people have called it home for centuries. Sandra moved to the little town of DeRoche just a few years ago, and it was her curiosity about her native neighbors that led to her proposing this series. Sandra is the winner of this year's Tai Fellowship. Her series Reconciliation is posted on the Tai website, thetai.ca, and Sandra Shields is with me now. Welcome.
Hi, Catherine.
Let's begin by talking first about this fellowship, Sandra. How did you find out about it?
Well, I've been a Tai reader since the since it was launched. So I found out about it on the online.
And did you right away know what you might want to be writing about?
Yes, I did. I had been interested in getting deeper into this, sinking my teeth into this subject for quite some time. I had been poking around it, and so this was an opportunity to get into it.
Where did your curiosity come from?
I guess that it really started. I work with my husband, photographer David Campion, and we had our first book looked at the situation that was facing an indigenous tribe of people living in southern Africa. They were really on the cusp of development. It was an interesting opportunity. It was perhaps like being in British Columbia 150 years ago at the time of the Fraser River Gold Rush. And what was clear with the Himba people in Namibia was that their future and the future of their children was tied to their continuing to have access to the lands on which they lived. It was tied to land title. And we returned to Canada, moved to British Columbia, right at the time that the Delgamuukw decision came down. And I think it was then that as non-Aboriginal Canadians, we really realized that we had in fact walked back into the same story about, I mean, essentially the same story about Aboriginal rights and title in our own country.
When did you realize that that big story was on your doorstep in DeRoche, British Columbia?
There's such a difference between living in urban and living in rural BC. And we had lived, when we moved to BC, we moved to Vancouver, Main, and Broadway. And you can be curious about the past in a big city, but the layers of industrial human habitation are pretty thick. Once we moved out to DeRoche, a farmhouse on the side of a mountain, the layers of human habitation are still there, but they are very different. And it didn't take very long before I started to become pretty curious about what those were. Anyway, we were very fortunate. A friend gave us a copy of the Stolo Atlas.
The Stolo Atlas, what's that?
It's a fabulous book. It was a project that was done by the Stolo people themselves back in the mid-90s. It's a large, beautiful book. Anyone who loves books, it's a fabulous treasure. And it's one of those books, it's a compendium of all of the different layers of history. There's archaeology, there's culture, there's the stories that are told about different places, there's all kinds of facts and statistics about the process of colonization that went on in the valley, as well as the kinds of history that had preceded it. Once you look at this book, you go for a walk down the road or up the trail, and it's a different experience.
You try to make sense of that experience in this series that you put together for the Tai. It's titled Reconciliation. Why begin there?
The series was an opportunity to look at the shape of the relationship that has developed between the Stolo and the many non-Aboriginal people like myself who have moved to their territory over the last 150 years. Specifically, what's happened in the last 2 years is that there has been what you could almost call a seismic shift in the relationship between the provincial government and Aboriginal people in this province. And so the Tai series was an opportunity to look at what's going on in the Fraser Valley through the lens of this new relationship or which is very much focused on reconciliation. 2 years ago, in June of 2005, the provincial government announced the formation of what they call the Ministry of Aboriginal Relations and Reconciliation,
which is a big shift from this government, which is the one that put forward a referendum asking people whether or not they wanted to proceed to discuss even Aboriginal title in British Columbia.
I think it can be very easy to miss the drama of what has actually happened. But the last 5 years in BC have been phenomenal. Prior to the Liberal government coming to power, Gordon Campbell had taken the Nisga Treaty to court and contested its constitutionality. He lost. And then in 2002, when the government came to power, that referendum went through, and there was all the debate about that. And even after that, it was literally in the spring of 2005, it's very early in 2005 that the earthquake happens, the seismic shift begins. It's obviously clearly driven by court cases. The very fact that in most of British Columbia, the government here never saw fit to make treaties with Aboriginal people left essentially the question of title to much of the land in the province open. It remains, and that was essentially what the Delgamuukw decision told us, was that where treaties are not made, the land may very well belong to the people who had originally lived here and had been living here for a very long time and who continue to live here still.
So these court cases put the onus back on the government to make some decisions, but you also alluded to the economy having a role in this. What do you see that as being?
Yeah, there was the BC economy took quite a hit. The Delgamuukw decision threw open the question of ownership over Crown land, which meant that any time there was any resource activity taking place on Crown land, the BC government's right to allow industry to go in and do the kinds of activities that industry likes to do on land, forestry, mining, oil and gas, all of these industry's capacity to go in and do these things on the okay of the provincial government was called into question. Essentially, it meant that court challenges brought forward by First Nations who had traditionally lived in those territories and used those territories could shut down industrial activities. And so the provincial government took a hit. Who was a capital intensive industry who wants to come in and start doing the kinds of work that's required to only find yourself tied up in extensive legal battles.
I think the word at the time was the horrible U word, uncertainty, which is something that business cannot cope with.
Exactly. And the resulting uncertainty definitely hurt the provincial economy and is ultimately, it's my sense and the sense of pretty much everyone who I talk to, that that is what brought the provincial government to this position where they were prepared to change. BC as a province has a history almost 150 years long of denying Aboriginal rights and title. And so this was... It was the economic uncertainty, I think, also the having 2010, but the concern that it would be unwise to have the cameras of the world focused on British Columbia and also have them at the same time have very articulate First Nations leaders across this province being very clear that there was a lot of issues that the province had not dealt with and really needed to. I mean, there's, a history of injustice that had not been addressed, had in many ways not been acknowledged, and had not even begun to be reconciled. And there we are back to that word, reconciliation.
So why that word? Why has the government decided to use reconciliation as its word to describe what's happening between the non and the native people in British Columbia?
There really has been, over the last couple of decades, an international move towards restorative justice. We saw it in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission there. And essentially what countries around the world have been finding is that when you have a history that involves injustice, that involves a conflict between parts of your population, if you don't address it, these things continue to fester. They don't go away. And so in countries around the world, there have been efforts made to start to find processes by which society can acknowledge and then start to look at what would make, would move towards making right historical injustices.
Is reconciliation something, though, that comes from a government office, or is it something that ought to grow from people in communities and neighborhoods like yours?
Marvelous question. Reconciliation is really theorists and people experiencing it, working through this process in different places. Reconciliation really, people are finding, must come both from the top down and from the bottom up. There's the interesting example of Australia, which I was very drawn to, having a similar sort of colonial history to the one that we have here in British Columbia, obviously with differences. But what has happened in Australia is very interesting. The same time as the Delgamuukw decision came down here, 1997, Australia, there was a public inquiry held into the residential school system in Australia. The man who led it, his name was Sir Ronald Wilson. He was a conservative figure in Australia, had been a World War II fighter pilot and then a lawyer and judge. He was transformed by the experience of leading this public inquiry. He had felt, I think like many Australians, he had felt like residential school had been, you know, sort of a way of helping the Aboriginal people in that country along. And instead, he heard wrenching testimony about the kinds of impact of a policy that separates children from their families, children from their culture, children from their land, from their language. And the ongoing legacy that that created of dysfunction, of really difficult social problems. So he heard all of this testimony, came out of it transformed, and came to the Australian people and to the parliament recommending very strongly that there be, that the country apologize, that the country...
What was the response to that? That must have been quite shocking for people to hear him.
Very much so for the prime minister who came in, John Howard. John Howard already felt like Aboriginal people in Australia had won enough concessions. There had been some land cases going through prior to that. And so he said no. Absolutely not. We do not need to apologize. And his position was that present generations are not responsible for past wrongs. And what ensued in Australia was this very widespread public debate. A couple of years later, in May of 2000, there was a march to say sorry. They called it Sorry Day. There was a Sorry Day march. And in Sydney, 250,000 people walked across the Sydney Bridge, Aboriginal people, non-Aboriginal people, this huge outpouring of, wow, we didn't realize, we are so sorry, that was so wrong. So it was very dramatic. I think it was really quite epic. I think it's quite unfortunate that it was not covered internationally as extensively as it might have been. Planes flew overhead and wrote sorry in the sky. It was a beautiful sunny day. And yeah, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australia smiled at one another for the first time probably in a long time.
So you've given us a couple of very clear descriptions of what reconciliation is. How is it playing out? And I know that you've approached your series in chapters. When you talk to people, what do they tell you about what they're seeing?
Yeah, I framed the series looking at what the province, giving a bit of background on what this whole idea of reconciliation is and why it's needed here, and the move on the part of the provincial government to change direction. But then what I wanted to do in the series was go out my door and see if it was actually starting to get any traction on the ground in the communities around where I live. So far in British Columbia, it is very much, for the most part, a top-down process. So while Australia's been bottom-up and it's been the grassroots movement in Australia of ordinary citizens that has, in conjunction with Aboriginal people, that has pushed the government there to start, and they're starting to make some steps. Here, it's come top-down. The courts ruled, the business was affected, the government started to respond. And so we have government policies beginning to change. Certainly government rhetoric has changed substantially. But on the ground, well, there can sometimes be a long way between government policy and what happens in communities.
So what did you find when you walked into your local school?
Going in there, I found out that in the mid-90s, there was a change in policy where school boards became accountable for the funding dollars that were being provided by the federal and provincial government for Aboriginal education. School districts now had to specifically account for what they were doing with that to further the Aboriginal educational aims. And there were two specific things that they did. One of them was starting to include Aboriginal content in curriculum. And the other was starting to ensure that there were Aboriginal support workers in the school so that Aboriginal students had some extra support when they needed it. And what I learned is that this has started to affect change. We are seeing Aboriginal students having better experiences as they go through the school system. I think one of the very important spin-offs that we're seeing is that we're seeing that all children who are going through the educational system now are getting a much better grounding in the history of, you know, frankly, the history of our province, of this place where we live, of this country. But coming at it from an Aboriginal perspective, that is starting to happen much more than it did previously.
Did you get a chance to speak to Aboriginal parents to find out what they think of these changes?
One of them said, you know, she said that she had been in residential school for a while and then she had gone to the local high school. And she said she did okay. She kind of kept her head down, but her brothers fought their way through high school. She said it was the same with her sons. They fought their way through high school. She said with her grandchildren who are going through school now, they're not having to fight their way through the school system. And so I got a sense, and also from speaking, that public education that includes much more Aboriginal content than it used to, there is still a long way to go, but that includes more Aboriginal content is having an effect in terms of the awareness of the young generation, you know, the next generation, the people who will be making the decisions in the future here. One of the themes as well, it was interesting and it kind of characterized this whole series. One of the things I was kept running into in the schools is while what was done and is being done has made a difference, there is still much more to be done. This is just the beginning. In the forests, it is very much, it is the early, early beginnings. So whereas in education, changes in policy started 15 years ago, in the forests, it's 2003 that the provincial government starts to open up what they call forest and range agreements. And they started for the first time to include First Nations in a very small cut, very, very small cut of the revenue coming from forestry. My sense is that it's you crack open the door, and then what happens is there's room for conversation, there's room for discussion. And already we're starting to see these agreements are called forest and range agreements, or forest and range opportunities is what they are now called. There were some problems with the way the parameters that the province had originally put on them. And so First Nations have lobbied and they've been changed. And this is where I say it opens up the door for a conversation. And so we are starting to see some changes where hopefully this will move in terms of becoming something that is economically viable for First Nations to participate in.
I guess, though, what it's all heading toward is real certainty, which is decisions about title, who owns the land. So your series ends at the negotiating table. People have been for years complaining that the treaty process in British Columbia is taking far too long. Everyone understands that it's going to take a period of time to come to some settlements. But where are we at? Do you see any movement there in terms of speeding up the treaty making process?
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens with we have three treaties right now that have signed final agreements with the province, where the First Nation has signed final agreements with the province, and they will be going through the ratification votes. So this means their members will be voting about whether or not they accept the treaties. It's going to be interesting and important to see what happens with those three treaties over the next number of months. In the Valley, the Lac Hamel First Nation, and the Lac Hamel have joined with, there's a number of different alliances of Stalo people in the valley. The Lacamel are part of what is called Stalo Nation, and they are participating with Stalo Nation in treaty negotiations with the province. The negotiations had been interrupted for a period of time.
With some pretty serious tension, I understand.
Very serious tension. Stalo Nation, however, which currently represents, I believe it's seven, it may be eight of the bands that are involved in treaty negotiations under the umbrella organization of Stalo Nation, have just come back to the table within the last couple of months and have a very ambitious timetable that they're working to. And so they are pushing very hard now to move towards having a final agreement in place by April of 2008. So we will see what happens with that, but what I understand is that things are at this point moving forward quite well with that table. So I think that the next year or two are going to be very key as far as treaties are concerned.
I want to go back to the beginning as we wrap up our conversation today and talk about the opportunity that this fellowship afforded you to look at solutions in journalism. What was it like to know that you could frame a series of stories, sort of looking ahead at what might be possible?
It's a refreshing perspective in some ways to take as a journalist, because we are often looking at social ills, the problems that are defining our society. And while this certainly has, while this whole subject certainly has many elements of that, it was refreshing to come at it from the perspective of looking at, okay, what is being done that is starting to make some difference? And also what could be done differently by the province, by, I think, ordinary British Columbians. I think all of us have a role to play and can take perhaps a note of the example in Australia that I think all ordinary citizens have something to do with the reconciliation process being successful.
What do you want people to take away from reading this series, Reconciliation?
I guess I feel like there is a real need for mainstream British Columbia. I think it applies to mainstream Canada. I think for a long time we've told ourselves a story about the history of this country that isn't accurate. And I think that we need to have the courage to rethink that, to look again at what Aboriginal people are telling us happened here, and, yeah, listen.
Thank you very much for coming in today and talking about this.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Catherine.
Sandra Shields, she's a writer. She lives in DeRoche, British Columbia, in British Columbia's Fraser Valley. Her four-part series, Reconciliation, is on the Tyee website at thetyee.ca. Sandra is this year's winner of the Tyee Fellowship for Solutions-Oriented Journalism. I'm Catherine Gretzinger.